Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Today and next week, we'll talk about generosity in Buddhism. We all give to others, and we all take for ourselves. The Buddhist practice of generosity radically shifts, for most of us, the balance between the two. Giving becomes habitual, new satisfaction is found in giving, and a shift also occurs in how we view our role in the world and in who we think we are. The systematic practice of generosity sets the direction our life will take in the most fundamental way, pointing it towards selflessness rather than towards self-advantage, which, perhaps surprisingly, turns out to be the direction that brings the greatest personal satisfaction and that leads eventually to awakening. The Pali word for generosity is dana, literally giving, which is commonly left untranslated in English language Buddhist literature. As a cognate of the English word donate, it's easy to remember, dana. It can refer to giving of material or immaterial things, from rice to teachings, from labor to advice, from cooking a meal that will delight and nourish one's family, to rescuing a flood victim from perilous waters, to helping overturn an unjust economic order. Generosity is eschewed by the stingy. Some of us keep our life of generosity close to home. Others think globally. Some of us respond to needs as they happen to arise. Others actively seek out opportunities to give. We might feed and clothe the homeless or contribute to a nonprofit that gives educational opportunities to the disadvantaged. We might see a turtle in the road, stop the car, and carry it to one side lest it be run over by a less mindful driver, or we might be present when a friend is going through a personal crisis. Being of benefit is practiced in more different ways than can be enumerated. The gradual instruction. Buddhist practice begins with generosity. This is evident in the gradual instruction, Anuppupikatha, which the Buddha presents in various discourses as a step-by-step guide for those just embarking on a spiritual quest. The gradual instruction begins with generosity and it unfolds as follows. Generosity, dana, precepts, sila, heavens, the drawbacks, degradation, and corruption of sensual passions, the rewards of renunciation, then on the basis of the understanding and pursuit of the foregoing, a mind ready, softened, unbiased, elated, and trusting as a precondition for the last step. The Four Noble Truths. The current series of talks loosely follows the sequence of the gradual instructions. The purpose of the Buddhist life is to establish us in the set of values, attitudes, understandings, practices, and other conditions based in virtue, harmony, and contentment that bring benefit to the world and are conducive to personal well-being and fulfillment. Once we're established in the Buddhist life, then we can proceed to the Buddhist path, which incorporates the Four Noble Truths. Most devout Buddhists historically have begun to live this way as very young children and have lived this way into old age, albeit with varying degrees of commitment. I hope in this series on Buddhist life to convey an appreciation for the remarkable practical depth and wisdom of the Buddha's early teachings on Buddhist life. The purpose of the Buddhist path is to establish us beyond this in a set of understandings and practices that ensure progress toward awakening, which, for present purposes, we can view as the perfection of human character, including absolute virtue, wisdom, and equanimity. This is the highest training, profound and highly sophisticated, which traditionally a small minority of the Buddhist population has fully committed itself to. The Buddhist life enables us to establish ourselves on the Buddhist path. The reasons we begin with generosity in the gradual instruction certainly includes the ease with which the practice is understood and taken up, even by children, and it includes the traditional community support around conventional generosity that the Buddha fashioned, and includes the immediate gratification that arises in conjunction with the practice of generosity, both on the giving and on the receiving end. Generosity also sets the theme of selflessness at a fundamental behavioral level, which will bear fruit on the Buddhist path in the profound realization that the notions of the self, at least in the way we normally understand it, is a kind of conceptual mistake. The next factor in the gradual instruction, precepts, sila, supplements generosity with the practice of harmlessness, the subject of the next couple of talks after generosity. Generosity and harmlessness are generally understood as explicit ethical guidelines. Heavens here is the prospect of personal fulfillment that comes with the virtuous life. This has to do with kamma, Sanskrit karma, and the fruits of kamma, the understanding of which provides a primary incentive for undertaking these practices as the accrual of merit. The next two factors, drawbacks, degradation, and corruption of sensual passions, and the rewards of renunciation, are realizations that we all too easily overlook in our own experience, but that arise with appropriate attention from the practices of generosity and harmlessness. Together, they provide the entryway into purification of mind, the topic of some future talks. The Buddhist path is largely an extension of the practice of purity. Precepts and generosity force us to struggle and compromise with those mental aspects that attempt to divert us from these practices. Sensual passions are our primary human motivations when no ethical considerations are present. These are presumably what motivate animals almost entirely, but for humans, ethical practices repeatedly force restraint of these sensual impulses. Generosity in particular gives frequent rise to supramundane feelings of delight and joy, which, like meditative states, are not rooted in sensualities. These considerations put a new light on the failure of the pursuit of sensual pleasures to provide personal well-being. In fact, at some point, these considerations will throw us for a loop and make us wonder why we ever began living the self-centered way we do in the first place. The more we investigate this, the more we discover the shallowness of pursuing satisfaction in selfish pursuits. This begins the process of renunciation the gateway to the remainder of Buddhist practice. The topics on generosity, harmlessness, and purity describe three aspects of Buddhist ethics referred to in the gradual instruction. The phrase, "the mind is ready, softened, unbiased, elated, and trusting," has to do with faith or trust and with opening up the heart and mind fully to receive the Dhamma. These are qualities of refuge, the topic of future talks. Understanding consequences. Back to generosity. Generosity is about bringing benefit. Accordingly, it belongs to the class of ethical systems that philosophers call consequentialism. It's guided by understanding the benefit, particularly for others, of any proposed action. Its ideal motivating principle is kindness, metta, though one might begin this practice even when kindness is initially weak. The Buddha introduced this practice to his newly ordained son as follows. What do you think, Rahula? What is a mirror for?
For reflection, sir.
In the same way, Rahula, bodily actions, verbal actions, and mental actions are to be done with repeated reflection. If on reflection you know that it would not cause affliction, it would be a skillful bodily action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then any bodily action of that sort is fit for you to do. What is said in this passage about skillful bodily actions with pleasant consequences being fit is then said in this discourse with regard to unskillful bodily actions with unpleasant consequences being unfit. And then what is said with regard to bodily actions is said about verbal and mental actions as well. Bodily, verbal, and mental are regarded throughout the discourses as the three basic kinds of action. The word for action here is kamma, or Sanskrit karma. Kamma means volitional action. Since all of our generous deeds are volitional, they are kamma. In fact, all deeds that have an ethical quality, beneficial or harmful, wholesome or unwholesome, are kamma. Moreover, all elements of Buddhist practice, ethics-based or not, are kamma. Notice that mental actions are referred to in the last passage as well. This makes purity of thought and such things as meditation practice kamma. Given that Buddhism is most fundamentally about practice, kamma is a very important concept indeed. Kamma and practice are inseparable. Our practice of generosity is, in the broadest sense, to aim for good consequences and thereby to give to the world. The world carries a burden of great suffering. It needs people to accomplish good now more than ever. The great challenge of accomplishing good is to trace as best as possible with discerning wisdom just what the heck all the consequences of our actions might be. We live in a very complex and highly interdependent world in which the consequences of the simplest action run very deep, playing themselves out almost forever. Consider the butterfly, as in butterfly effect, who by choosing to fly from one flower to the next will, as meteorologists tell us, trigger storms and hurricanes on the other side of the world in the decades and centuries to come that otherwise would not have occurred, or prevent those that would have. Similarly, our actions may, or more likely will, enable wars to happen or not to happen, and we may never know. We, like chess players, can only see a few moves ahead to a certain horizon with relative certainty. Beyond that, we are, each of us, simultaneously nearly omnipotent and absurdly nearsighted. This is why the Buddha recommended that Rahula must consider his actions with great care. Merit making. A groundbreaking operating principle in Buddhism is that an ethical, virtuous, generous, non-harming, pure life is not only beneficial to others, but is at the same time quite reliably a source of benefit and satisfaction for ourselves. We can begin to appreciate the intimate connection between these two when we observe that generous, open-hearted people tend to be happy people, and stingy, self-centered people tend to be unhappy. As we do generous deeds, rescue some kittens from a fire, or offer the plumber a cup of coffee, we can think of ourselves as earning personal merit, much as a Cub Scout earns merit badges. Merit, punya, is a kind of approximate composite measure of the ethical value of an action, a tool that incorporates both external consequences and the intentions and sacrifice of the actor in performing an action. Merit is closely related to kamma, and particularly to what are called the fruits of kamma, which we'll explore more deeply in future talks. Actions that bring harm to others and are ill-intentioned make demerit, papa. Merit-making conceptually quantifies generosity as something we accumulate, something that is vaguely measurable. Since the practice of generosity benefits both others and ourselves, this way of looking at practice makes sense. Something like merit-making is commonplace in many of our activities when we want to ensure persistence in our practice. For instance, the jogger generally tracks how many miles he runs per day or per week as a defense against creeping negligence. Similarly, the meditator typically tracks hours on the cushion for similar reasons. Whenever we take on a practice commitment, we want to evaluate how well we are fulfilling that commitment. Merit gives us a rough metric. Although I've emphasized the intrinsic, open-ended nature of generosity, merit-making is most often applied in conventional contexts in which accrued merit can be associated with a specific array of factors. In addition to consequential benefit, merit is attributed to certain categories of recipients, to certain categories of gifts, to certain manners of giving, and to certain intentions behind giving, roughly as follows. First, to whom is it given? Worthy recipients of generosity are ascetics and priests who live on alms, destitutes, wayfarers, wanderers, the sick and beggars, as well as family members and guests. These are generally those in need or for whom we bear a special responsibility. Additionally, the purity of the recipient correlates with the amount of merit made. For instance, offerings to those of great spiritual attainment gain oodles of merit. Notice that these in turn are people with a great capacity for making merit themselves, and so supporting them is likely to multiply the beneficial consequences of our deeds. In analogy to planting seeds, such recipients are often called fields of merit, punyaketta. Buddhist monks and nuns tend to be distinguished in this regard. 2. What is given? The gift of Dhamma, Dhammadana, exceeds all other gifts, which tends to give monastics and those of great spiritual attainment an edge in merit-making. Although most other gifts are material, the gift of service, weya wacha, is also very meritorious. It's important to note that the merit earned tends to correlate inversely with one's resources. For instance, a meager offering from a pauper might easily gain more merit than a sumptuous gift from a tycoon. This is because it's ultimately the intentions and level of sacrifice that count, which we'll come to in a moment. 3. How is it given? The Buddha recommends that offerings never be given in a callous manner, but rather respectfully, not in a way that humiliates the recipient, and ideally with one's own hands rather than through an intermediary. It's also best to give at a proper time and to give what is not harmful. Notice that these recommendations encourage direct engagement in and full experience of the act of giving. In this way, these measures encourage feelings of friendship, appreciation, and interpersonal harmony in association with the act of generosity. They also enhance the personal benefit of giving to such a degree that one begins to lose track of who is the giver and who is the receiver in a particular transaction. For giving feels so good that one begins to think of oneself as a recipient. This manner of giving would also suggest that it's better to be actively present at the orphanage to which we are donating rather than simply writing out a periodic check or arranging an automatic fund transfer. Notice that that would also allow us more closely to track the consequences for harm or benefit of one's generosity. Finally, 4, why is it given? One might physically give with different intentions, out of annoyance, out of fear, in exchange, thinking generosity is considered good, to gain a good reputation, out of kindness, with awareness of the personal consequences, or to beautify and adorn the mind. The first 3 of these are fairly neutral with regard to merit, since in each case one's intention is generally to gain something as much as to give something. The last one earns a truckload of merit. Again, we find intention to be critical, for merit ultimately is about purity of mind. In general, it's best to give with no expectation of personal benefit. Also, if we feel happy before, during, and after giving, we are in the swing of this practice. When this gift of mine is given, it makes the mind serene, gratification and joy arise. Accordingly, we should take care that there is later no resentment for having given. The purest form of giving is with the attitude, it is an ornament for the mind, an accessory of the mind. Notice how the Buddha's emphasis in discussing generosity moves freely from benefit for others to our own personal experience and back again. Pure acts of giving are expected to gladden the heart and contribute to the development of personal character. This often creates some confusion concerning intention for the modern student of Buddhism. Are we practicing generosity for them or for us? Out of benevolence or out of selfishness? Many conclude merit-making is a self-centered enterprise, but paradoxically, generosity gains the most merit for us when our intentions are based in pure kindness and compassion for the other, and the least merit when our intentions are more self-centered. It feels great when our intention is to benefit others. We attain the most personal benefit when personal benefit is not our primary aim. In fact, one of the ways we practice generosity is to be gracious in our acceptance of gifts from others and to be a fertile field of merit by paying that generosity forward to others. Welcome to the through-the-looking-glass world of generosity.